Hey folks, welcome to the Adventure Sports Podcast. I am usually the host, but today we're throwing this one back to 2015 with Jerry Roach. Jerry is what you call a legend. He has climbed over 2,000 mountains, the seven summits, all of Colorado's 14ers, and all of Colorado's 13ers, which there are over 600 of. So pretty amazing accomplishments. And he has literally written the books on climbing in Colorado. So if you have ever looked up a book on mountaineering in Colorado, it's probably one of Jerry's books. He's written like over a dozen books at this point. And this episode, by the way, is one of our first ever, episode 42. So this goes way back to 2015. Kurt's doing the interview, like I said. And also, shout out to my buddy Micah, who recently climbed one of the Colorado 14ers, one of the harder ones, Capitol Peak, which has something called the Knife's Edge. Go look up YouTube videos of this. It's terrifying. It's crazy. And Micah, congrats. He didn't think he could do it. He went out, made it happen, completed it, got home safe. And who knows, maybe this is the start of doing all of them. Pick up one of Jerry's books, Micah, and who knows, maybe this is the start of it. Also, we closed out the Gnarly Nutrition giveaway last week. Congrats to the two lucky winners of the show. And just so you know, we're going to do another giveaway here soon, including a giveaway with Athletic Brewing. We are not running this giveaway, but Athletic Brewing, that my day job, is doing this. We are giving away literally a $45,000 camping trailer. Go check it out, athleticbrewing.com. You'll see it like right on the homepage or somewhere near there. It's super easy to sign up and get yourself a chance to win the grand prize, but there's also lots of other prizes like stoves and Yeti coolers and all kinds of stuff that you could win. So go sign up for that. I'll put a link in the show notes and be on the lookout and listening for our next giveaway here on ASP. So thanks for listening. Let's go ahead and jump in.
Hello, friends, and welcome to the Adventure Sports Podcast. Today, we have an amazing guest for you. Jerry Roach is one of the premier mountain climbers, not only in Colorado, but also in the world. But he's famed for all of his efforts in Colorado. He's written more than 15 books, climbing guides, and other things to help mountain climbers find their way. And his exploits are just amazing. So Jerry moved to Boulder, Colorado as a lad in 1954, and he started rock climbing and bouldering then, but his climbing continued on until he had climbed all of Colorado's 14ers, and then he continued on to try some of the 13ers, and then he expanded until he has climbed peaks all over the world. He's climbed the seven highest peaks on the seven continents, including Mount Everest, including Denali and several others. He continued from there, and he has climbed more than 2,000 peaks in Colorado. He's climbed every ranked 13er, and those are all of the mountains that are over 13,000 feet tall. He has done all of the highest points in all of the 50 U.S. states, so he's done the 50 summits for the United States. Jerry, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me, Kurt, and howdy, folks.
Well, Jerry, it's a real honor for me to talk to you. I want to tell the guests, one of my primary sports for the last 20 years or so has been climbing the 14ers and 13ers of Colorado, and Jerry's books have been very valuable to me in helping me figure out how to find a trailhead, which trail to take, which routes I want to try, and how safe or unsafe the various routes are, what the distances are, what kind of gear and equipment I'm going to need. I jokingly say, but it really is true, Jerry has probably saved more lives than anyone else in Colorado because his books have guided people to safety. So, Jerry, thank you for being on the program, and thank you for your efforts to document the Colorado mountains for all of us out there who love mountaineering.
Well, it's fun, and I'm glad to share.
Well, Jerry, will you take a few minutes to tell us more about yourself and your connection to your mountaineering?
Like Kurt said, I moved to Boulder under the Flatirons in 1954. I was a sixth grade, seventh grade coming along. And one of the answers to the famous why climb question was there, staring me in the face every day when I was out in the schoolyard. It was the Flatirons. And I looked up, and frankly, it was just instinct. Never mind all the fancy answers. Yes, the Flatirons had to be there. I did have to see them. But it was instinct, and I just wondered if I could climb them. So off we went, me and a school buddy. No equipment, no training, no knowledge. The only thing we knew about climbing was what we had seen in a cartoon, where some crazy cartoon figure had a rope dangling freely into space and another person yelling crazy things. And there was a pick and a hammer attached to the cartoon figure. That's all we knew about climbing. You needed a rope, you needed a pick, and you needed a hammer. We had no idea what to do with any of those things. So we stole our parents' clothesline, which was cotton in those days, later tested at about 60 pounds.
Oh, no.
And we borrowed a claw hammer from my dad's tool chest. We didn't have a pick thing, so we forgot about that part. Then we went up to the Flatirons with no training. It's amazing that we survived those initial encounters with real rock, plenty steep enough to kill you. That's not how I recommend starting.
No.
Get training, all that good, sane stuff. But we did survive. We were on the sneak. We couldn't tell anybody what we were doing. Our climbs got bolder and bolder. We got a rope Orlon. We couldn't afford nylon, so we bought Orlon at the Army surplus store and really scared ourselves. Finally, our parents did find out, as parents always do, and grounded us. I thought my climbing career was over, and it was for a little while. Then, of course, as parents often do, they relented and said, well, you can climb, but you got to get proper training. And in the 50s in Boulder, the best place to get training was with Rocky Mountain Rescue Group, where we literally learned the ropes from older people. Pretty soon, we knew a lot about what to do with a rope. Not just climbing, but also rescue operations, Tyrolean traverses, lifting, lowering, complicated maneuvers. And I look back on that, I think that was the place to start, with real training, learning the ropes, literally. I think rock climbing is a great way to start a career in mountaineering. You've got to know how to tie every knot upside down, backwards, in the shower, in the dark. That's sort of a joke, but you get the idea. You've got to know how to set a rappel, to place an anchor, all those things. It's fundamental. In a nutshell, practice fundamentals over and over and over till they're second nature. You don't think and you don't make mistakes. Famous quote, climbing is paying attention to things. Hang on to that one. So that was my beginning. The climbs, of course, got bolder and bolder. We were too young to drive cars, so initially the climbs were the Flatirons and El Dorado Springs. Then we got clever and learned how to bum rides up to Long's Peak. Started doing routes on the east face of Long's Peak. I think I climbed Long's something like a dozen times before I ever did the keyhole route.
Wow.
We always went up the east face and down the north face or down some other way. And that was my grounding. That's how I got into it. And from there, of course, the Indian Peaks were close. The bum rides to the Indian Peaks and the park. So that's where I started climbing, the mountains. And there were trips. We discovered some other outfits. Of course, the Colorado Mountain Club was there. There was a loose-knit group, the University of Colorado Hiking Club. We met people. Back then, it was all word of mouth. Everybody knew everybody. A lot of gossip, a lot of chatter. There were no significant guidebooks. I remember the old original Orm's Guide to the Colorado Mountains. Those little stick maps in there. We'd pore over them trying to divine the details, which, of course, weren't there. Here's the standard description of climbing a mountain in Colorado. Go up the valley, turn either left or right, climb to the ridge, and follow the ridge to the summit.
That's right.
That's what we grew up with. You just had to know whether to turn left or right. And you knew how to have, you had to know how to get to the trailhead. But that's what we grew up with. And wow. Got more and more ambitious. We took trips with groups to various 14ers. I remember doing Calibra, the now famous Calibra. Back in those days, we just threw our bags out at the base of the S Ridge and climbed the entire S Ridge the next day. Didn't think a thing about it. We did routes then, that some of which are not even in my 14er guide today. we just parked and went up the hill. It was very seat of the pants, but that's how we learned. Sometimes we went straight up the hill to our demise. And you learn. Here's a good story relates to the guidebooks. Orms was the guide man living in Colorado Springs. One middle of the night, it was a dark and stormy night. It was raining. Bam, 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 bam. On Orms' door, middle of the night, he puts on his bathrobe, he goes out, looks out there, and there's about three or four climbers in ponchos. It's raining. He answers the door, turns on the porch light, and the guy said, "Bob, look at this description you wrote." You said, "Go up the wall to the ledge and turn left." He fumbles for his glasses. He's barely awake, puts his glasses on, and he grabs the book and he reads the sentence and the paragraph. He scratches his head and he says, "Left? No, 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 I meant right." These guys had gone left and bivouacked, and it was miserable. They survived. And I learned from that it really matters what you say. Fast forwarding a little bit to my own guides, I was a software engineer for decades, writing code where, exaggerating a little perhaps, but it's a good illustration. If you type a comma instead of a period, you could fly a plane into a mountain.
Yeah, yeah, no doubt.
The code to be absolutely precise and bug-free and all those good things. So I had a background as a software engineer, and code is just another language. English is a good one, but code is another one. And I combined that code writing skill with my scientific bent and all my climbing and the knowledge that you say left, you better mean left. And I just started writing guidebooks later, decades later.
Well, I tell you, your guidebooks are the premier. They're the best. And if anyone wants to take up climbing in Colorado, they need to start by perusing your books. And you can learn so much that'll keep you safe, keep you on the right route. You'll know to go right instead of left or left instead of right. And you'll know the distances. You'll know how to watch for bad weather. You'll know just about everything that you need to know to at least have an aggressive hike up a mountain. So, Jerry, I appreciate what you've done in documenting mountaineering for all of us.
Well, thank you. I hope so. One comment is that my guides are where to. They're not how to. I do let my opinions leak in there from time to time. But frankly, the book is too thick already. If I kept putting in all kinds of opinions about safety issues, it would double in size and be unwieldy. Just be aware that it's a guidebook, not a how-to book. There's lots of other good how-to books. In fact, I thought I ought to write my own, and maybe I will. That could be a nice future project.
Well, there are a lot of backpacking, wilderness, and even emergency and survival skills that people need to learn before they take off on these big mountains. And so I agree, it's worthwhile. People need to get experience. Start small, work your way up. It's all fun. And so there's nothing wasted in learning those basic skills first.
Absolutely. Climbing today is centralized. Everyone wants to do Long's Peak, Mount Rainier, Denali, Everest. Stop. Then they move on to some other sport. Well, it's not that easy. I did a much longer version of that, decades in the making. Different era, yes. I didn't have the money, yes. But fundamentals. I did Everest back in the days when we really had to climb the mountain. I take some pride in having led a portion of every part of the route, base camp to summit. These days, people clip in. I have a hard time believing this, but I'm told there's fixed rope from base camp to the summit.
Wow.
7 miles of rope. And the clients don't lead a step. The Sherpas lead everything, fix the anchors, fix the ropes, cook the meals, all of that, carry the loads. My goodness, it's changed. I've been to Everest initially in 76 and again in 83 when I made the tippy top. Both of those trips, the climbers had to lead the route. do much, if not most, of the fixing. We carried our own stuff. We pitched our own tents. We cooked our own meals. I'm glad I had that experience. I wouldn't want to go there now with the current scene.
It takes some of the reality out of it, doesn't it?
Yes, I led a trek to base camp in 96, the year of the disaster. And even then, that's now almost 20 years ago, that I was blown away. Base camp was a mile long, 300 tents, full of egos and pretense and blah, blah, blah. I could not believe it. So for myself, I am glad I lived when I did. Now, having said all that, Everest is only one mountain. Jumping back to Colorado, people say, oh, the 14ers are crowded. Same basic complaint. All you have to do, people, there's nothing left. I don't like the line, we're loving the mountains to death. No. If we were loving the mountains to death, Colorado would look like Kansas. It doesn't. There are hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of mountains in Colorado. I would say most of which you can find solitude on.
That's right.
The 13ers come to mind. I'd climbed 13ers, of course, over the years, but it was only with my wife Jennifer that I got going hard on doing them all, because she was doing them all, and she drugged me out to do all these obscure low ones that I'd never heard of. I loved them. You had to figure everything out, just like the old days on Everest.
Yeah, that's right.
There's no guide. You looked at the map. Yes, we had good maps. Maybe you talked to a friend, maybe not. You'd look at the mountain and say, well, if a fellow had to climb that mountain, let's see, I think I'd go over this way. And you'd try it. And sometimes it worked. And occasionally you had to make adjustments, try something different, come down a different way. It was real mountaineering. And I fell in love with that and rediscovered Colorado, if you will, and eventually finished all the 13ers.
Let's take a quick message break and hear from the folks that helped make this show possible. That is plenty of that for now. Let's get back into the episode.
So that's no small feat. Tell our guests again, when you say all the 13ers, how many hundreds of peaks are we talking about?
The official magic number is 637 ranked peaks in Colorado over 13,000 feet. That includes the 14ers. Just taking 13ers, peaks between 13 and 14,000 feet, there's 587 13ers.
587 13ers. Right. You know, there are quite a few people that try to bag all the 14ers, and the magic number is usually around 54. And you can describe to our listeners why that, I said usually, but
yes.
54 is a lot of mountains, and people spend a lifetime, because of limited time, trying to get their 54 peaks. But we're talking about, you're doing about 700, and that's just the beginning of your portfolio. Where did you find the time?
That's a big question, which I get a lot. I worked. One big answer, part of that answer, is I didn't have kids. I didn't have a family. I was able to devote weekends, every holiday, every evening. Local stuff would run out in the evening, climb a rock or do a trail run. You learn how to, past tense, we learned how to play the game, maxing every available holiday, every available half day. We had whatever vacations. Well, then what about the bigger peaks? It gets complicated. If you need a month off to go to Alaska for Denali or something like that. Frankly, I got the reputation in Round Boulder, you're the guy who quits to go climbing.
So you made your own sabbaticals.
Yes. I only did that after I'd exhausted all the other avenues. Once I arranged for a 2-week trip to Alaska, we got trapped. It took 3 weeks. I came back and I said, I played this card. You can only play this card once. Oh, we were trapped. We were going to die. I'm lucky to be alive. Do I still have a job? Oh, mercy, mercy. And I wiggled out of it. I just lost a week's pay. You can only play that card once. You can only play the Everest card once. And occasionally I would quit. Another piece of that answer is I discovered contracting as my career evolved and it became less career centric, where you worked for one company forever and ever. I discovered I could be a contractor. That worked very well for several years, where I could contract 6 months a year, make good money, and climb the rest of the time and time it out, plan. And that's how, frankly, a lot of my bigger trips happened back when I was still able to get a job. Now, one of my lines now is I'm not retired. I just can't get a job anymore. two things have happened. I'm playing this game I'm describing. And one day I woke up and two things happened. One, most of the software engineering jobs had, in fact, been shipped overseas. And two, I'd gotten old. And age discrimination is alive and well in this country.
That's
they can't. I don't care what the banner on the wall says. They just don't hire you. I recently applied to Facebook and Google. I got the predicted response, which was silence. I've learned the hard way. You can apply for 10 jobs. You might get a reply from one.
Right.
Once you amass 10 replies, you'll discover that 9 of those replies are see you later, goodbye. Then the one remaining reply may offer you a phone interview. 10 of those, you'll flunk 9 of them. 10 of what's left, you might get a real interview and you'll flunk 9 of those. You get the picture.
So it's a 1 out of 1,000 is the job that you land.
And basically you don't. Then the age card gets played and, oh, well, we hired this other person because they're more experienced. Oh, by the way, they're younger. Yeah.
Jerry, it's kind of fun you brought this up. I'd like to mention, you obviously have a passion in your life. You love the mountains. You love climbing them. You love detailing them for others. And that passion was just a huge part of what your career has been so far. And there's a new paradigm in the United States when it comes to looking for a job. It's hard to find a job, like you just described. That really is the process. And people have to understand that it takes persistence and tenacity and patience to land the job you're looking for. But there's another alternative, and that is to chase your passions. And there's a whole new world of entrepreneurs these days who are saying, you know what, maybe that company's not going to hire me. So what do I love to do and how can I help others do that? And that's part of what you did through writing your books. And so I really encourage people to think about the new paradigm. Don't think that a corporation is going to be out there to pave the road for a easy, happy life. We have to pick ourselves up by our own bootstraps and hit the pavement. We've got to start doing that work ourselves.
Absolutely correct. I'm talking to a lot of friends. Everyone's got their own version of the story I just gave you. You have to step outside that corporate box and have your own idea, your own passion, and try it. 9 out of 10 business starts fail. That's another bad statistic, but that doesn't mean you don't try.
Well, that means you only have to try 9 things before you have a hit.
That's right. Well, my books are interesting story. A lot of people say, oh, you're an author, you must be rich. Well, I have a whole speech about that. My 14er book sold pretty well, still is, although sales of the paper book are going down because of the internet. That's another subject. But the 14er book, by happenstance, has sold for me. It was no genius on my part. I just happened to write it at the right time. I caught the wave, if you will. I thought, well, this is great. If I could write 10 books like this, I'd quit my day job. So I wrote 10 books. Well, the truth is that the 14er book sells more than all my other books combined.
So there's your 9-to-1 ratio.
It is. And you wonder why it is that one ballet dancer makes it and 10,000 don't. You know, it's tricky business. You need a good agent, which I'd never have had. Anybody out there want to be my agent? Anyway, it's tricky.
You know, what you've just described, though, that the perseverance and tenacity that's required in our modern world can be learned on these 14ers, on these 13ers, on these big peaks, because, you know, most people find, some people are in better shape than others, but most people find they can get to the top of a 14er if they don't give up on the mental game, because that's the hard part.
Yes. That's a great subject. The part of the answer to the great question, why climb, is that climbing is a great paradigm for the rest of life. A mountain has much of the elements of life. You've got this difficulty, you've got political this, permit that, oops, it's raining, oops, the trail is closed or the road is gated, or the weather's bad, and you've got to cope and deal with all of those things. And if you can figure it out on a mountain, you can apply those lessons to much of the rest of your life. People say, oh, climbers are nuts. They're just taking unnecessary risks. They're crazy. No. I think it's the other way around. Climbers do something that most corporate tycoons don't do. It's called risk assessment.
Right.
Yeah, climbers by nature do risk assessment. They look at the weather. They look at the avalanche slope. They consider the fall that's below them. And they're usually willing to turn around if it's not right. I joke, perhaps, that if corporations were climbers, they'd be dead because they
take too many risks.
They don't do a good job of risk assessment. I've seen it over and over and over in my corporate years,
right?
Such as they were. So I think climbers, in many ways, are some of the smarter people around. It's not just climbers; it's all, if you want to call it, extreme sports people. I know you talk to a lot of different sports. So anybody that's hanging it out thinks a lot about what they're doing and consequences.
Sure.
Like parenting, if parenting a kid, you've got to teach them consequences for their actions. And sometimes it's beyond what you can teach. They got to go out and hurt themselves. Hopefully they don't kill themselves. Well, we did. We made it back in the days. Big subject. I love it. Could go on and on.
Well, there are many lessons that we can learn from climbing these mountains. And I think that the biggest things are the memories that we form while we're doing it. Every mountain has its own personality, and our interactions with those mountains. Each mountain creates a new dynamic. It's like a conversation. And you remember the mountain as if it's a person almost. You know, this mountain tried to do this to me or had this feel to it. And we have all these memories, but we also are getting physical exercise. We're relieving stress. We're learning how to make wise decisions and do risk assessment. We're finding our own physical limits and even overcoming them. I mean, it's an amazing sport that you do, Jerry.
Yes, it is. And that's been my passion for about 60 years now.
Wow.
Small hint about how old I am. You can figure it out if you want to.
Well, hey, will you tell us an amazing story, something that helped to just sell you on the sport?
Sure. Back to Long's Peak, which was probably the first serious mountain that I was climbing on. We would climb rock routes on the east face. Rock routes always, or typically, if they're on the lower face, would end at Broadway. And you can traverse off from there and descend Lamb's Slide and be done for the day. A lot of rock climbs do that. You climb a face or a ridge and you get somewhere and you traverse off and go down. You've climbed the route, but you haven't climbed the peak.
Right.
Every time I got to Broadway, and my partners rapidly learned this about me, I said, we're going to the summit of the mountain. We had to do the whole upper half of the mountain. Often we went on with the upper keeners, sometimes Notch Kuar. And I made it, it was just the passion to always go to the summit of the peak, no matter how hard the route was that we'd already finished. And that's where I learned the love of the high peaks, was always going to the top. And I love to spend as much time as possible on the summit. Maybe this is how I learned how to acclimate and get good at high altitude. I doubt it's that simple, but still, I like to lounge on the summit. I like to go fast as I can, and then spend whatever extra time I have on the summit. And they're all special.
Oh, yeah.
The summit is the, people say, oh, the the joy is on the slopes. It has nothing to do with something. Well, it's both. Yes, the slopes are where you spend most of your time. But without the summit, you're not mountain climbing. You're just a walker, a hiker.
That's true.
But you're walking on the Colorado Trail or something. So I am very summit-oriented. Moving a little different direction, I was attracted from that beginnings to bigger and bigger, higher, higher, bigger, bigger mountains. And that's how I got into climbing so many of the big peaks up north in Alaska and the Yukon, because they really brought it home. Those big peaks are a huge chess game. All the things I mentioned, you don't know, and you don't always make it. But we evolved a philosophy and a technique that where we made it most of the time. A big component of that is something else that corporations don't do a very good job of, patience. We learned how to be patient. If you lunge at a goal, more often than not, you're going to fail. And if you lunge repeatedly, maybe you'll figure out how to make it with a lunge. But that's not a good tactic on a big mountain where there's lots of hazards that can kill you. Maybe it works on a skateboard or something where you're just going to scuff an elbow. But I don't recommend lunging on big peaks. Doesn't mean you can't go fast and light. You have to plan that with extreme care. People say, oh, you can't control the weather. Well, hey, you can control whether you're there or not when the weather's bad.
That's true. So
you have a lot more controls than you think. Anyway, I love the big peaks for the chess game aspect of it. And I've been pretty successful at the big peaks. I went on to, I believe, as near as we can know such a thing, that I was the first person to climb the 10 highest major peaks in North America. Went on to do three more 16ers and rounded out the list of the 13 highest in North America. It wasn't because that's a list that I had to finish. It was just the peaks that I wanted to do. I like short lists. Seven summits comes to mind.
Yep.
When I finished the Seven Continent Summits, I think I had the record for taking the longest to do it. 22 years, I think it was.
Well, you weren't on those mountains for all 22 years, though.
No, that was the elapsed time.
That's fun. Well, hey, will you tell us about a time that things did not go right?
Yes, I'll be forthright. I've lost a lot of friends, climbing acquaintances and partners over the years, but only one trip I've been on did I experience a fatality from somebody on the trip that I was on. It was 1971 when we tried to climb the south face of Chacuarahu in Peru. At the time, the south face was unclimbed. We went at it. If you remember, this was the year after the big earthquake in Peru that shook Huascarán and killed 20,000 people.
Wow.
And Yungay, 80,000 people died across the region. Huge disaster. It was a year later. Who knows the mechanics of some of these big features on the mountains? We've just had an earthquake in Nepal, brought down avalanches. Who knows what has weakened and is still waiting to come down? Anyway, we were high on the face. I was leading, traversed out above a fluting, took one axe blow too many, and the entire fluting gave way, thundered down, almost took out the camp below. And one of our team members was conked in the head and later died. That was bad. It was horrendous.
Wow. We were
19,000 feet. Didn't know if we were going to live or die. And long story, it's in one of my books, Ride the Breath, that story is in, if you want the details. And that was pretty shaking. And looking back on that climb, the climb wasn't my idea. It was somebody else's passion, vision. Boy, knowing what I know now, I would do it very differently. I would have chosen a different gully, a different route, blah, 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 a lot of technical details. But it's those technical details that make the difference most of the time. It's the left-right thing.
Sure.
Sometimes it's fuzzy left and fuzzy right. It's not always so simple. It's choices. So that memory still haunts me. That was 1971. And those things will stick with you. I've had friends who've experienced too many of those accidents and just quit climbing. They gave it up and took up ultra running or something else that's still tough but safer.
Sure. You know, I think not everybody is a good decision maker. Not everyone has those risk assessment skills. I think a lot of it is intuition.
Yes.
And if there's a sense about it. And I've climbed with people who you think, why did they do that? You know, and then you just realize, well, they didn't see what was coming if they were to do that. And it's not for everyone. So there are some people that probably should take up distance running.
Yes, there are.
You know, if we don't stay alive to enjoy our sport another day, then what have we done?
There's lots of quotes. There's a one-liner for everything, of course. But one of my, I've got answers to the why climb question that range from one word to a library. My one-word answer is joy. Mm. We get joy from climbing, and that we can bring down with us, never mind a paradigm for all these complicated life things. Just coming down filled with joy, you can transmit that to other people. And a guidebook's a hard place to transmit joy. I should do that in other books, and I've tried, but darn, they haven't sold.
Well, hey, let's get the word out about those books. If you will, tell us about some of your books and let us know what they're about so people can go find them.
Sure. My website is simple. It's SummitSight, SIGHT.com. It's a big site, 300 and something pages, all kinds of fun things in there. But I have what I call Bookland. Click on that and you'll get a menu of all my books, guidebooks, yes. But I've written a bunch of narratives, which is really what I wanted to write in the first place, was my stories. Well, the 14er guide sold and blah, blah, blah. It took me a long time to get to my narratives. But I have in order a book called Transcendent Summits. Darn it, it's out of print, but I'm going to fix that. The sequel is called Ride the Breath. Transcendent Summits talks about how and why I started. And a lot of times when I sign the book, I'll write in there, remember why you started. Because when you started, you were full of joy and simple emotion, passion. It's good to remember that. The Transcendent Summits talks about those early years when we snuck off to go climbing with a clothesline. Ride the Breath was an active period later, including the Chakarahu story, when I climbed around the world twice. Then I wanted to write the seven summit stories because that's popular and it's something I did. And so I created a trilogy, which I titled Beyond the Seven Summits. Turned into a trilogy for a couple of reasons. It took me a long time to write it, and I put books out as I went along. It's in three pieces, pre-Everest, Everest, and after Everest. Each one a book of it stands on its own. The three of them tie together. The seven summits, seven continent summits, plus, plus. By putting the word beyond in the title, I was free to write about anything. So I did. I put in a lot of other stories. My climb on Mount Foraker in 1975, my climb on Mount Blackburn in 77 in Alaska, and many other stories are in there. It's a very rich series, the trilogy. Another book I did that many I think would enjoy is a history book on Everest. It's titled Why Everest? Subtitle is A Short History of the Pioneers. Two keywords, short and pioneers. I contend that more has been written about Everest than all other mountaineering literature combined. Just a feeling, not a scientific proof. And yes, you can read all this history, but oh God, some of these old books go on for 500 pages. The typical thing is you don't reach base camp till page 100. And by modern standards, we don't have time to get through all that. So I took it upon myself to combine my code writing skills, my guidebook writing skills, my love of storytelling, which I practiced in my other books. And I brought it together in Why Everest to tell the history from the beginning through, turned out, 1983. Originally, I was only going to write it through the first ascent, 53. But I found the history of Everest to be so rich and so much fun and so telling in human history that I just kept going. Well, then the question was, where do I stop? I knew I didn't want to write the history right up to present day. Well, friend said, well, that's simple. You write until you stood on top and that's the end. Well, I said, oh, I can't do that. Well, so I defined the pioneering period on Everest as follows. Everest is a tri-pyramid peak, three major faces, three major ridges. They had all been climbed. Everest had been done in all four seasons, including monsoon and winter. It had been done solo, true solo, of course, Messner 81. It had been done without supplemental oxygen. And I considered those things to be all the major mountaineering firsts on that mountain. Prophetically, all those things were completed in 1983, the year I stood on top.
It worked out.
It worked out. So I put myself, picture of myself on top on the cover, but you can do that when you self-publish. But it's fun. It's a good book. It's not long. A friend of mine who said that he reads a lot of history books, he proclaimed it a good history book. So that's another book I had fun with, Why Everest. I'd been out of writing for a while. I wanted to get back in. I thought, I've got to get back into the swing of it. So I treated writing like driving in a parking lot. There are no rules. So I just wrote whatever came to mind, and I created a little book of short stories called Orthogonal Adventures, and that was fun. Other stuff. What's an orthogonal adventure? Well, orthogonal is perpendicular. Translated to mountaineering, it means something went wrong with every outing. And what did we do about it? Well, there's lessons in that. So that all my books are there. Get some words from on my site, summitsite.com. And you can order from me. A few of them are out of print. Most are not. I plan to get the out-of-print ones back. One of my one-liners is, gee, if there were 10 of me, I could get twice as much done.
That's good. I sometimes feel that way myself.
I'm under a lot of pressure to reproduce my high 13er guide, and I'm working on it. But then there's the economic reality. It's a big effort, 1,000 hours to do it upright, and it just doesn't sell enough to justify the effort. But I hope I do intend to do that, and I am plugging away at it. Anyway,
I encourage everybody that likes to climb to consider the 13ers because of all the things that you've already listed for us. You know, it's more the true mountaineering experience, and you get away from the crowds, and you can have limitless mountains where you don't see another soul, and you're out there really learning the mountain. So I think your 13ers book, it needs to be out there. People need to know that there's an alternative to 14ers, which is even a bigger experience. The 13ers might be a few feet shy of the magic 14,000 feet, but it doesn't make them easier. And the altitude is about the same, and the route finding involved and what have you, it's a whole new challenge. A lot of the 13ers are far more difficult than the 14ers.
Correct. The hardest 14er by its easiest route, well, you can debate which one it is, but whichever one it is, it's class 4 in difficulty. The 100 highest, I call them centennial 13ers, there's 50-some 13ers combined with the 14ers to make the 100 highest peaks in Colorado. The hardest centennial 13ers are class 5. There's three of them, Dallas, Teakettle, and Jagged. So yes, there are harder 13ers. That's an interesting piece. They're also harder because there's not a beaten trail up them like there is on a lot of 14ers.
Sure.
I've found in the Himalayas and Andes that the lower peaks are often harder than the highest. Oh, the 8,000 meter peaks, they're the toughest. Well, they are the highest, and there's the least oxygen there. But a lot of the 7,000 meter peaks are harder. Why? Well, because they're more eroded and they're steeper, simply stated. And therein lies huge challenges. And I think to some degree, the same thing is true in Colorado. The 13ers are often more eroded and therefore steeper.
Well, back to the books, you mentioned before the show here that you have some editions of your 14er book that are at a better price. Tell us what's going on with that.
Yes, I just, in the last few months, my publisher for the 14er guide is Fulcrum, based in Golden, has been since day one. Fulcrum, for their own reasons, jumped the price of the third edition of my 14er guide from $22.95 to $29.95, a whopping $7 jump. And I was aghast when I heard this. What? There go my sales. I'm shot. Well, the reasons, why did they do that? Well, it's a modern day answer. They gave up trying to print the book in China. A lot of reasons behind that. Prices, a lot of things. Prices in China have gone up with new security issues, all that. There's more duty. There's more security issues. You got to jump through more hoops. And a big one is the slow boat from China really is slow. It takes weeks and weeks. One time I got frustrated and I said, well, why don't you just FedEx them? And they laughed and said, Jerry, books are heavy. Do you know how much it would cost to FedEx 10,000 14er books from China? It's ridiculous. So they gave up on China and shopped for a printer in North America and found one, solved all those problems, and you guessed it, the price jumped up $7. Sign of the times. I think we can see more of that too. Anyway, I quickly, as soon as I learned that, I snapped up every copy of the book that Fulcrum had at the old price. So I have a good stock of third edition 14er guides at the old price, $22.95. I might even knock a dollar off of that. So if you want to save a little, you can buy it off my website. Now, darn the luck with my site, you got to pay shipping, typically $6 for priority mail, but you'll get it right away in mint condition and signed. And if you want me to personalize it, I can do that. Don't be shy. If it's a birthday present or a gift for somebody, I can easily personalize it. You can even tell me what to say, and I'll write exactly what you want. Tell this person, blah, blah, blah. Anything you want, within reason.
Oh, that's fun. So yeah. It sounds like you've written a lot of great books. You've also outlined a book here in the podcast, and maybe some of your narratives touch on this, but life lessons that we can learn from mountaineering. I think you need to write that book, Jerry.
Well, I have been thinking about it. It's a how-to, maybe more than just a detailed guide to how-to. It could be a storybook how-to. Well, look, we did this wrong and this thing happened, and my orthogonal adventures touch on that. This thing went wrong and this is what we learned from that. Yes, I think there's a book there.
You bet. Well, hey, how does mountaineering benefit others? Why do you encourage people to do mountaineering?
Well, we've touched on some of that. You can transmit joy. Any activity that creates joy, I think, is worth pursuing. Various arts, music certainly can. Most art forms are created to transmit joy. Darn the luck, most art forms don't make it in our society. They're relegated to... People that do it anyway are relegated to a cheap or poorly paid lifestyle. We hear about the people that make it, but for every one of those, there's 10,000 that don't. But joy is a big piece of it. Beauty. If we don't have beauty and joy and passion in our lives, I think we devolve. If it's all about the corporate bottom line, next month's paycheck, I think we're going backwards.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah.
So that's a big component. And some of the other more technical aspects, the paradigm for life, these big peaks tell you a lot. There are times you have to turn around, many times. Turning around is always an option. People think that Reinhold Messner, all he ever did was just march up to the top of all these great peaks. What a hero. Reality is, if you read the fine print in his books, he turned around a lot. About 50% of the time. Well, that's the life lesson. It's not as easy as just being a hero. You've got to learn how to play the game.
Oh, yeah. That's excellent. So Finish us up here with a funny story about climbing.
Well, let's see. Here's one. Simple one. Sometimes simple is better. A group of four of us took off one day in a storm to hike up Bear Peak above Boulder on the trail. Just a good hike to do on a stormy day. One of the four guys, Dan, said he wanted to traverse over to South Boulder Peak. Well, the other three of us didn't want to do that. He was insistent. So he took off to run over to South Boulder, top speed. And we waited and chatted. And pretty soon, we saw Dan appear on the rocky ridge south off the summit of Bear Peak. His head would pop up over a boulder, and he'd look at us and, oh my God, what are they doing? He had a wild countenance. Then he'd climb some more, and he'd pop up on another boulder. And finally, he scrambled up to us, and he blurted out, how did you guys get over here so fast? And we didn't know what he was talking about. But then we figured it out, and we played along. And we said, Dan, well, we just followed the trail. played it. We strung him along. And he was gasping for breath. He could not believe that we were calmly sitting on top of South Boulder Peak. And he'd gone so fast, and we'd beat him. Well, he'd gotten completely turned around, 180 in the fog, and had reclimbed Bear Peak. Finally, busting out of laughter, we had to break it to him. Dan, this is the summit of Bear Peak. We haven't moved. And at first, he couldn't believe us. He said, South Boulder Peak. And we said, Dan, look, here's the registered canister. Here's the rock. You were just here. We haven't moved. We've been sitting here. You got turned around in a fog. You know, long silence.
Oh, that's good.
And he had to realize he'd gotten completely turned around in the fog. Well, there's a lesson there. It was a funny thing. No harm done. We hiked down together laughing. But yeah, you learn from that one way or another. I mean, there's lots to learn. I've been turned around 180 in the fog. It's real. Anyway, a lot of fun.
You bet. I think people get turned around 180 in the fog commonly in their lives, and it may not be on a mountain. So.
Yes.
Very good. Well, Jerry, thank you so much for your time today. And to our listeners out there, Jerry Roach is just an amazing guy. Pick up his books and find out about what this sport, you know, is all about. It's an amazing adventure, and it's worth spending a lifetime on. I can personally attest to that. Joy, beauty, passion, you mentioned those things as reasons, and those are great reasons. So until our next episode, get out there and have some fun.
Be safe.
First of all, thank you so much for listening. It means the world to us that you choose to listen to this show. If you'd like to help us further, you can leave a review on iTunes, share us with your friends, your family. It goes a long way to grow in the show. You can also support us financially through patreon.com/adventuresportspodcast. Link is in the show notes. And also, if you have an idea of who could be a good guest for the show, we're always looking for people to tell their story about the outdoors or adventure. So if you know someone, please reach out. Email us at info@adventuresportspodcast.com. And until then, get out there and have some fun.
Save big money on your next project now at Menards. Update your home with low-maintenance vinyl windows from Jeld-Wen. They're durable, energy efficient, and are low-maintenance. Menards carries over 100 different size and style options in stock, ready to take home today. Save big on Jeld-Wen windows now at Menards. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.